Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol and also on Preston FM 103.2, and not forgetting Radio Verulam in St Albans. Coming up in the show,
and a lot of the conflict was hand-to-hand fighting on the ground. It wasn't the same as it became with bombs when the conflict became more developed.
It's the final part of our reporter Anthea Page's visit to Shank Hill Road, the area in Belfast where the scenes of the most violent troubles during the Northern Ireland conflict occurred.
Malcolm Grieve reads another chapter from Lady Stanhope's journey about her travels in the Middle East. This week, the travel on towards Jerusalem. The poet Rosemary Dunn is here in the studio. We've also got Tim Burrows singing us a song. And we finish, as usual, with the Watson Guide, courtesy of Jeff Sparks. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. Our guest in the studio this week is David Worthington from the New Rooms, the Wesley Chapel in the heart of Bristol city centre, which is now dwarfed by towering shops and retail units. But first, let's hear one of Charles Wesley's famous hymns. He was the younger brother of John Wesley, whose bronze figure on horseback dominates the courtyard of the New Rooms. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. David Worthington to the studio, who is the manager of a premises called The New Rooms. Hello.
Good evening.
Tell me, what are The New Rooms and where are they?
The New Rooms is the oldest Methodist building in the world. They're located in Broadmead in the heart of Bristol city centre. And we welcome around 25,000 visitors in every year, coming from all different parts of the globe to come and understand more about John and Charles Wesley and the birth of the Methodist movement.
Okay, so are you yourself a Methodist?
I personally belong to the Anglican Church, which of course was the church that both John and Charles belonged to. They never formally left the Anglican Church. They were involved with the establishment of the Methodist movement, as it was known in the 18th century.
Okay.
It subsequently became a denomination in the way we know it today in the early part of the 19th century.
Is Anglican, you know, a lot of people might find the variations in all these various movements and denominations confusing. So Anglican is the Church of England.
Yes.
Yes, okay. When people think about all of these varying movements, they come across such a broad spectrum of history that it's kind of difficult to pick out why they felt that the movement was needed in the first place. I mean, the Quakers obviously had their own particular interest during the Civil War, and that stems from them. So why did John and Charles Wesley feel that a movement was required?
Well, the Methodist movement was initially established at Oxford University, where John and Charles were undergraduates. And they felt as though many of those who were studying, particularly theology, were not upholding what they considered to be good Christian values. And so they established a group of like-minded men who came together to pray and to study the Bible, but also to do practical works, to go out and to visit prisoners or to work with the poor. And this, they felt, was very much living out the New Testament traditions. And it's really this movement. The word Methodist comes from the word methodical. It was a rather mocking term that they were given in Oxford. It wasn't a compliment to be known as a Methodist. But essentially, they said that we are creatures of habit, and it's better to get us into good habits as opposed to bad habits, which we'll drop into if we don't have good methodical habits.
They didn't necessarily seek to start a named movement as such.
No, I think that if you look at the evidence, certainly Wesley tried to engage with the Anglican Church. However, what the Church was saying at that time was that if you wanted to come and hear the Word of God being preached, you would have to do so within the church environment. Unfortunately, many of those who then tried to go into a church were often refused entry.
Well, why would they be refused entry?
Often rather spurious reasons, that they were not dressed appropriately, that they didn't know how to behave in church, that they were not going to contribute financially towards the work of the church.
And that's quite significantly anti-Christian and quite prejudiced, isn't it? You know, somebody's not dressed in a nice suit, right, you can't come in my church and be religious.
I completely agree with you, and I think that was what's so radical about the Wesley's ministry. They took the New Testament example of Christ going out and meeting the people where the people were. One of the first groups that the Wesleys engaged with here in Bristol was in the Kingswood area of the city, the Kingswood miners. These were a group of people who were eking out a living. No local Anglican church. And so initially John and subsequently Charles and many others began an engagement with these people. And what very quickly emerged was that they were human beings with feelings and emotions, and they wanted access to the same things that others were enjoying. So, for example, for their children to have an education. That's one of the reasons why the new room, one of its first uses was as a school and also a dispensary for medicines. Sometimes very easy in our 21st century environment to assume that there was universal health care and education available to all.
So tell me a little bit about their background, John and Charles. They were at Oxford at university?
Yes, they were both born in a little village called Epworth in Lincolnshire. Their father was an Anglican minister, but possibly the most influential parent was their mother, Susanna Wesley, often referred to as the mother of Methodism. Probably two reasons. One, she gave birth to 19 children, but secondly, she also disciplined them. And we're back to, again, this methodical nature of prayer and study, but also working and engaging with the poor and the disenfranchised. They then subsequently went to a school in London before going to study at Oxford. Right. But both John and Charles's parents were very much from what we would call a dissenting background. In other words, these were people that challenged the traditions and the authority of the Anglican Church.
Okay, so nonconformist in nature.
Yes.
So. Okay, and what drew them to Bristol? Were they training to obviously go into the priesthood at the time when they were going to?
They were already ordained ministers at that time. Bristol in the 19th century was the second largest city to London, and of course a major maritime city, and involved, of course, in the trades.
So lots of fallen souls.
Lots of fallen souls in Bristol, which probably remains today. But the reality is that it was the second city, and of course, as we know, Bristol is very much built on what many consider to be the vices, with its engagement with the tobacco and the spirits, and of course so the slave industry as well.
So, I mean, the new rooms, if I'm thinking of the right place, is, you know, you kind of go down Union Street where, you know, you've got the Odeon Cinema, and there's a sort of an interjunction where the buses come in, it's all busy, and you've got the Tesco's on the corner. And none of that sounds very old, so Where do the new rooms, you know, how do they come to be there and what is it sort of like inside? A lot of people would never have set foot across the door.
Well, this area of Broadmead was a busy area in the 18th century. Today, of course, as you rightly say, we're surrounded by a lot of retail units. And the word that most people use when they come into the new room is an oasis of peace and calm. It's perhaps a traditional 18th century Georgian chapel. It has pews and benches on the ground floor, and then it has a balcony level. There is also a double pulpit, which is very typical within Methodist churches. The upper pulpit would be for the preacher, and the lower pulpit is where they would read the Bible and lead worship from.
Okay, so it's quite sort of Victorian style then, I'm assuming, is it?
No, it's Georgian, so it's a little bit older still. And then you've got the accommodation immediately above. John Wesley was a very practical man, a man who believed in the use of buildings for all sorts of purposes. Before we talked about multi-purpose, Wesley was thinking about this in the 18th century. So it was a hotbed of religious and political debate. One of the most famous occasions Wesley preached at the New Room was his Thoughts Upon Slavery sermon that led to a riot. So you just get a feeling of lots of different activity going on within the building, but Wesley essentially using it as a base for his work in Bristol
so
and beyond.
Would he have interacted with the anti-slavery campaigners that used to meet historically famously at the Seven Stars pub, which is a stone's throw from there?
Yes, and of course perhaps the most famous abolitionist, William Wilberforce, was very influenced by Wesley's ministry and became a Christian through that. In fact, the last letter John Wesley ever wrote was to William Wilberforce to encourage him to continue in his role as the Member of Parliament to lobby government, of course, for a change in the Slave Trade Act.
What about, there is a lot of Methodism abroad, obviously, in America and foreign countries, and that was the height of imperialism and Britain's influence all over the world. I mean, how did it spread and how far has it spread?
Well, the Methodist Church today is the same size as the Anglican Church, around 75 million members.
Right.
It's probably spread to a wider degree around the world, partly, as you rightly say, through the influence of empire, but of course also the development of American influence around the world. So there are 8 million American Methodists. The largest Methodist congregation in the world is the US, but the second is in South Korea, again, because of the American political influence over the last 50 years.
And is this something that is still relatively, you know, has it become sort of hidebound to the traditions of, you know, you go to an ordinary church, or is it still, do you think, is it still in its roots in terms of going out and seeing people where they are?
I think it's the latter. In fact, I hope it's the latter, because I think that there is still a need for this engagement with people where they are in their circumstances, rather than expecting them always to walk through a church door. I think for me that is what the Methodist Church is about. It's that willingness to go out and engage with people where they are and to come alongside them and to listen and understand and try and offer practical solutions to the problems that they're facing.
If people, sort of, a lot of people in Britain are effectively sort of semi-religious in an unofficial capacity. So, I mean, if you've got any sort of last words for this particular interview and somebody finds this sort of message that you're, you know, saying quite interesting or appealing, what advice have you got just for somebody, you know, who might be at home and thinking, well, I don't know, am I interested?
Well, the Methodist Church has a number of congregations around the UK. It is a national denomination. I think that if people are based in Bristol and want to come to the New Room, we can always help them or direct them towards others who may be able to help them. For me, it's about allowing people to come and have a listening ear. Sometimes that's what they need. Sometimes there's more practical help and support.
Okay. And when can people come?
The New Room is open from Monday to Saturday from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. And if you'd like to come in, we're open throughout the year and we'd love to see you.
Brilliant. Well, David Worthington, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Without it now, London would be unthinkable. Queues everywhere and aggro every time you change trains or buses. I'm talking about the London Travel Card, of course. It was introduced in the 1980s, and there may be a lot of lessons for public transport in Bristol when we realise that lower fares can actually bring in more money in terms of fares and profit for the companies. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to former bus conductor Dave Wetzel, the man who brought the public transport revolution from Paris to London.
We'd seen the French carte orange in Paris, and I've now met the person that actually introduced that to Paris. We thought it was a much better system to have zonal fares and one ticket that would take you on all modes of public transport. We were elected in 81, but in the 70s, some of the officers had suggested this to the board of London Transport, and they totally dismissed it, and they said travel patterns in London were totally different to travel patterns in Paris, and the Carte Orange would never work in London. To give them their credit, by the time we got elected, they were prepared to work on it, but the pace of change that they suggested was much slower than we had originally anticipated. We had public consultation on the basis that we were going to cut fares by 25%. We'd put that in our manifesto, and we'd also put the Carte Orange in our manifesto. But politicians being politicians, you should never trust the word of a politician, because we didn't cut the fares by 25%. We cut the fares by 32%. And we introduced bus passes with that first change, but it was too early to do the Carte Orange and integrate the underground with the bus in terms of fares and ticketing. But we did make the underground zonal. And the big advantage for that, particularly for those people crossing London to the centre and then back out again, for many of those people, we halved their fares, because once they paid to the centre, they'd crossed all the zones, so going further out didn't cost them any additional money.
Where was the logic, Dave, in cutting the fares? Because from a financial point of view, people are just going to throw their hands up and say, well, that's a crazy thing to do.
Well, a lot of people said that, and of course that was a big argument that the Conservatives put up, and we won the election and they didn't. But I kept saying, after our fares fair was declared illegal, eventually by the House of Lords, and fares had to double, I was saying that lawlords are bigger vandals in ermine than people, youngsters getting on the buses doing a bit of scrawling.
Can you explain how cutting fares on public transport can actually benefit the network?
The thing that it does, it reduces the unit cost of operating a bus or a train, because you attract a lot more people to it. It doesn't recoup its cost. You've got to give in a bigger subsidy. But the interesting thing is that when we cut by 32%, the amount of money it was assumed that we would have to give was a massive overestimate. It didn't make a profit, but it certainly wasn't as costly as most professionals thought at the time it would be. The real beauty is that you reduce car commuting, and therefore you reduce pollution on the streets, you reduce congestion, you reduce the number of traffic accidents and people getting killed and injured on the roads as a direct result of encouraging people to leave their cars at home and use public transport.
But Dave, it takes people years to change their travel habits, doesn't it?
As well as reducing the fares, we also improved the services so that we were offering a better service to attract people. But most people think about their travel patterns when they're moving home. They might buy a home which is closer to a station or to a motorway if they're going to use cars, when people get married, when they get divorced, when they leave school and start work for the first time, or leave university or arrive at a university town. These are the sort of times when people make major decisions about transport. And of course, once a person has invested in a car, it takes a lot for them to decide, well, I won't use my car, I'll leave it at home. The interesting thing is that in Paris, there is more car ownership than in London, but less car use than in London. And we cited that as the example of how not just cheaper fares, but integrating the ticketing to make it the Commonwealth of public transport, as compared to seeing coaches, buses, taxis, underground train, mainline train all competing with each other. We didn't see it that way. We saw public transport competing with the private car. And our first fare only lasted for 6 months. And in that 6 months, people that had company cars, there was no financial incentive for them to give up a company car. And at that time, 79% of cars entering central London in the morning peak period were funded in some way by the employers. And in South Yorkshire, for many years previously, they had had a 6p fare. It wasn't a flat fare system. They still kept graduated fares. And they didn't have integrated ticketing because they only controlled the buses and nothing else. But nevertheless, South Yorkshire, compared to West Yorkshire and other comparable counties, had much lower car ownership. They had lower car use and much higher use of public transport. So it was on the basis of that that we argued why we should do two things. One, cut fares, and two, improve the public transport offer. We wanted to include British Rail in our fares fare and to reduce the British Rail fares by a comparable amount. And the Thatcher government told British Rail, which then was a complete nationalised industry, that every penny they took off of us, they would take off of government grant to British Rail. So British Rail was in a position, they just couldn't come in on fares fare, although the professionals there would have all preferred to have done so. Bromley has no tube trains whatsoever and relied on buses. They got the benefit of the cut in fares on buses, but a lot of Bromley residents commute into London on National Rail and British Rail then. Didn't get any financial benefit. To pay for fares fare, we had to put out a supplementary rate. Having got elected in May 81, October 81, we put out a supplementary rate. And three Bromley councillors, one of whom was also a GLC councillor, all Tories of course, met together in a pub and decided that they would put on a challenge. They couldn't get any other Conservative authority, let alone any other party, to join them. So they did it alone. And in the High Court, the GLC won. They then appealed, and the appeal was heard by Lord Denning, Tom Denning. He found in the favour of Bromley Council. So we appealed to the House of Lords, and the three law lords found in favour of Bromley.
That was former Chair of Transport at the Greater London Council, Dave Wetzel, with possibly some lessons to get Bristol's public transport working better. Next week, Dave explains that even though his party won an election based on their plans for reducing London's transport fares, the appeal court finally ruled that they were not allowed to do it and then forced them into increase fares to an even higher price than they were previously.
Our next feature is the final part of our roving reporter Anthea Page's recent trip by car to the Shankill Road area, made famous in history as the scene of the worst of the Northern Ireland Troubles.
Belfast was a village. It was an area north of Belfast called the Shank Hill, and therefore the Shank Hill Road developed.
What year did the British Army arrive here?
69, in support of civil powers, to support the police, who were 3,000 policemen who effectively couldn't cope with the civil unrest.
People glad to see the army arrive or not?
Yes, everybody was at the time, yes.
Did the army behave themselves when they were here?
Well, At the beginning, yes, but then there were incidents, of course, because you're dealing with human nature, and there's always that kind of problem, isn't there, when you're dealing with human nature. The Scottish soldiers were murdered just up the hill. They were off duty. They were in the centre of Belfast. They were lured away by three girls. They were lured away and then they were taken away and murdered by the IRA. And that kind of stopped. The army then became into that kind of situation where they couldn't really mix with the local people. They became very much onto themselves. But it wasn't safe to mix with local people. You didn't know who was going to be a kind of a fifth columnist and drag you away and have you shot.
When was the last troops on the streets of Belfast?
After the Belfast Agreement sometime, I can't remember dates. But troops are still stationed here, of course, because we're part of the United Kingdom. And there are still military barracks here, as there are in Wales and Scotland and England. This is the Glen Cairn estate here, a big estate that was built as part of the redevelopment of Belfast. And therefore, a lot of folks from the Shankill were moved up into this Glen Cairn area. And that was before the Troubles.
Tell me about the Shankill Road pronunciation.
Well, the general English pronunciation of the alphabet is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K. The kind of Celtic, Catholic pronunciation is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M. And therefore, people often at nights would be stopped by various paramilitary groups and asked to recite the alphabet, so that they could identify which community they came from. And if they came the wrong one, they'd get a bit of lead in their head. This is an orange hall here called the White Rock Orange Hall. There's a parade up to here the last Saturday in June every year. It has, for some years, down the lower part of the Springfield Road, which we didn't drive up, has caused some conflict.
What's this say? Bring Hill Westport Massacre. This is 1972,
yes.
Belfast Bloody Sunday. It says the British Army murdered five Irish citizens.
Well, yes, well, the Paras were in here. They came under fire. They returned fire, and obviously all the people who they thought were carrying arms or whatever. And when bullets are flying, it's, you know, it's very difficult. This would be a Catholic area now we're in. Catholic stroke nationalist stroke Republican. Whatever kind of designation you want to put on it.
Is it all Catholics, or do people live side by side now?
Not so much in Belfast. Very little of that in Belfast. Some areas, yes, some of the more middle class areas. There would be mixed housing, but most social housing would be single identity social housing. It would be identified with one community or another.
So where does this actually stop then? Where do we stop being Catholic and go into Protestant?
Well, we've just come out of Protestant into Catholic, and we're going to try and go down the, what's called the White Rock Road, down to drive down the falls, and then head on up to Stormont.
So, is there any demarcation?
Well, the demarcation was further back there at the top of the Springfield Road, where the Springfield Road met the West Circle Road, the roundabout we came around. That's a kind of a demarcation line there. So we're hitting a lot of school traffic now that slows us down. Again, you see a lot of murals have appeared also on walls around here, highlighting various parts of...
It's a council house with the whole of the end wall,
yes, you find
painted
that
in a big mural, political mural.
Yes.
Oh, here we are, look. On the right as we go up, it's got collusion, state murder, the usual suspects. And it's got a row of men with their backs turned with labels on. Murder, 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 it
well,
says.
People who were commonly called, as we said before, the Supergrass Trials. People like Brian Nelson, you see, was one involved in what was called the Supergrass Trials.
We've got one label there, media coverage, British surveillance.
They blame
intelligence.
The media. They blame everybody. Everybody's to blame.
There's another one there, Ballymurphy Massacre.
Uh-huh.
It's terrible. It's everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah. This was all, I remember all this being green fields when I was a child. We used to walk up here
There's like individual plaques with words on. That's quite powerful. No more pain. Dreadful. It's like war in the suburbs. There's another mural coming out on the side of this council house. And that shows soldiers with guns. It's IRA men with guns.
This is the city cemetery, the big, larger cemetery.
War murals here, aren't there? What are these two?
Somebody who was shot. Kevin Lynch was shot.
So we're going down the hill now to the Falls Road and we can see Belfast stretched out in the distance. Oh, there's a mural here. What's this about? This is more sport.
It's a boxer, yeah.
There's horse racing, boxing. So that's a non-war mural. A big mural on the wall here. It's a Sinn Féin trade union movement. Absolutely incredible how history is here on the walls. What's that?
Hunger strikers there, Nugent.
Large-scale murals, history, painted everywhere.
Over there, called Broadway Church. Orangemen used to parade there, have an annual service. Haven't done that for many a year. It's now a culture, an Irish language cultural centre. It's called Culturalan.
Just in the mural, it says 17 people killed, including women and children. Conflict Resolution Services, Ireland. Oh, we're in the Falls, part of the Falls.
To my left is St Mary's University College and the famous Royal Victoria Hospital. First of all, the Royal Victoria Children's Hospital, and now the major Royal Victoria Hospital, where there's considerable rebuilding going on.
Conflict happened here in the Falls Road.
Little things like murders, you know, people dying and all, yeah. When I'm coming down to one of the major thoroughfares between the Protestant Shankill and the Catholic Falls, it's called Northumberland Street. We've already referred to that on the way up the Shankill. We're now referring to it on the way down the Falls. At this road junction, there's been a fair bit of conflict at the very beginning, and barriers, of course, were put up to separate the communities. This side to my left, there was a large mill called the New Northern Mill, but now, of course, milling and that kind of industry is gone, so it's now redeveloped. There's also, before that, Conway Mill. These were all big mills in the days of industry in Belfast.
There's a whole wall here of murals, political murals.
Here's Percy Street, which goes up onto the Shankill Road again on my left. This is barricaded off, because this too was a point of conflict in the earlier days of the Troubles, when a lot of the conflict was hand-to-hand fighting on the ground. It wasn't the same as it became with bombs, when the conflict became more developed.
If the British Army hadn't arrived, would you have had a full-scale civil war then?
Well, some people do say that would have been better, at least it went over and done with a lot quicker and wouldn't have lasted for 40-odd years. When I go on to the what's called the West Link, which takes you onto the motorway, I'm going to get over to East Belfast and to Stormont.
Was Anthea Page there reporting from the Shankill Road area of Belfast. As you heard at the end of the feature, the car takes a turn to the direction of Stormont. Next week we'll be visiting the seat of the Northern Irish Parliament at Stormont, known to many as the familiar sweep of drive that follows up to a magnificent grand building standing at the top of the hill. Our story this week is another chapter from the book of Lady Stanhope's travels in the Ottoman Empire, the Middle East. This week the caravan travels through Syria on its way to Jerusalem. Lady Stanhope was a niece of William Pitt, and she travelled where no European woman had ever travelled before. Sadly, at the end of her life, she was deeply in debt and shunned by her family, renouncing her British citizenship, and she died destitute in 1839 in a dilapidated monastery in Lebanon. Malcolm Grieve reads part two of Lady Hester Stanhope's Queen of the Desert.
Lady Hester Stanhope's travels. It was a splendid cavalcade that set out for Jerusalem. Lady Hester rode at the head of the column with two saises or grooms walking at her horse's head. She was magnificently clothed in a Mameluke travelling costume bought in Cairo. A satin vest and red cloth jacket were matched by trousers of the same cloth, gorgeously embroidered with gold at the pockets, as well before as behind. Dr. Merriam was entranced with her appearance, and has always managed to describe it in great detail. The trousers were large and loose, as is the fashion in Turkey, and when worn formed by their numerous folds a very beautiful drapery. Over the whole, when on horseback, she wore the burnous, or white hooded cloak, the pendant tassels and silky look of which gave great elegance to her figure. Another beautiful cashmere shawl was worn as a turban, and as a final elegant touch. Her saddle and bridle were matching too, crimson velvet embroidered with gold. As they rode through the countryside, they passed large fields of watermelons, and great flights of storks rose flapping into the sky, startled by the sight and sound of the caravan. There were orchards of every description, lemon, orange, peach, almond and pomegranate, but most were young trees. 15 years before, when the French army had invaded, all the mature trees had been hacked down to use as firewood. It was a wonderfully fertile place, and the recently planted trees were approaching maturity. But even as they approached the end of their first day's ride, they came across a plague of locusts. At one place, the insects had covered a house and tree so completely that both seemed to be bright green. Great swarms were seen, marching in a straight line, not to be stopped by any impediment. And dreadful was the havoc that they had made. Making sure they were well out of the path of the marauding locusts, they made camp for the night in an orchard of olive trees. It was now over 2 years since Lady Hester and Charles Merriam had left England. They had come a long way together, not only geographically, but also in understanding of the Muslim people. At first, the linguistic and cultural differences had been so enormous that they had made the inevitable British mistake of assuming foreign ways to be inferior. They had learned by now, as they travelled further eastwards, to respect and often admire the customs that had at first been so puzzling to them. They had also begun to appreciate the Turkish language and were able to understand most of what was said to them. It was a short step to being able to speak Turkish themselves. Lady Hester loved the personal freedom she had and the respect she was paid by all she met. Merriam was enjoying his new prosperity, security and social status. The Near East was beginning to feel most comfortable to them both. Michael Bruce was not so appreciative. He had always been an impatient man, an unrewarding thing to be with Arabs or Turks, and he seemed to find them increasingly difficult to deal with. He was no less in love with Hester than he had been from the start of their affair, but he found it hard always to be in second place to her during their visits with local dignitaries. Now that time had passed and Hester was not quite so dazzled by love, she was beginning to suspect that the ambitious predictions she had so confidently made for Michael were unlikely to come true. He still seemed keen enough to learn from her, but he remained strangely immature in many ways. Henry Pierce had left the party at Jaffa, and perhaps Michael missed a male companion. Certainly life was not quite so blissful now. He was prone to bad moods and sulky behaviour. He constantly found fault with the servants, who began to depart with alarming regularity, and the old animosity he had felt for Merriam began to emerge once more. It was therefore with very differing feelings that the three main members of the party prepared for their first night under the stars of the Syrian sky. Lady Hester and Michael had a magnificent marquee that was romantically painted with flowers. Merriam had a smaller tent, and there was a large one set apart for the servants, two of whom were employed solely for the pitching and striking of camp. The countryside was utterly beautiful, and Merriam waxed eloquent again. In a climate where the sky is more serene than a mirror, where the most delicious fruits are more than abundant, where the bosom expands with hilarity from the very air one breathes, you cannot forgive the man who is not happy. Everything was enchanting. Michael, sitting glumly in his beautiful marquee, would have been driven to new levels of exasperation by such fervour. In the morning the party pressed on. The path they took wound through the mountains and the territory of a marauding sheik called Abu Ghosh, who levied a tax on everyone passing through his domain. This tax was usually taken by force, but when he saw the richness of Lady Hester's caravan and realised that she was an important foreigner, he decided the polite approach might be better advised. Abu Ghosh received us very courteously, Merian wrote in his journal. He killed a sheep for us, gave us corn for our animals, and supplied all our wants. This infamous brigand was fascinated to meet Lady Hester, and most impressed to see that she was not at all frightened of him. He ordered his four wives to cook a meal, and they all vied with each other to produce the most delicious combination of meat and rice, which was the extent of their larder. Dinner consisted of lamb stuffed with rice, lamb coated with rice, lamb chopped up in rice, and lamb and rice wrapped in vine leaves. But the conversation was sparkling and made up for the somewhat monotonous food, so all was not lost. When it was time for her to retire, one of Lady Hester's Mamelukes sensibly suggested putting guards around their camp to protect them from possible treachery on the part of their host or his men. There was a very real danger that they might be robbed or worse, and Hester was wondering what best to do when she had a flash of inspiration. She decided to ask Abu Ghosh if he himself would provide guards for them. By doing this, Lady Hester was placing the lives of herself and her party in Abu Ghosh's hands, but she knew it was the right thing to do. Ever since she was a child, Lady Hester had relied on her intuition about people, their intentions and motivations. And although it was a long way from the drawing rooms of London to the draughty tent of a dubious Arab in the mountains of Palestine, her intuitions were just as finely tuned and just as trustworthy as they had always been. Merian was often astonished at how quickly and acutely she could make an assessment of someone, but he too learned to trust what he could not understand, even when on this occasion, as on many others to come, the gamble they were taking was with their lives. As nearly always in matters of this kind, Lady Hester was right. Abu Ghosh was so gratified at being trusted by this great English lady that he promptly abandoned any thoughts of pillage he might have had and insisted on keeping watch himself. He sat up all night by a large fire, and in the morning he and Hester parted the best of friends. She gave him a handsome present, and ever after he spoke of her with great admiration and respect.
That was Malcolm Grieve there reading part two of Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert by Virginia Childs.
I'd like to welcome Rosemary Dunn. Hello.
Hello there.
You are a poet by profession and you've been on this show many times. Do you have more poetry?
I do, yes.
Excellent.
Okay, so this first one is about Bristol. I like to write about Bristol, obviously, being a Bristol poet. And it's called Shipshape Bristol Fashion. Summer returns to old Bristol docks as locals tan winter white knees. John Cabot, bronze cast, points forever upriver, hair unstirred by Atlantic breeze. It's the festival of the sea and Saturday nights buoyed up by Pim's glasses hoisted to cheers. Salt air and tequila press gangs into nightclubs. Those chilled on the pavement trip hop in for beers. Shipshape Bristol fashion are Sasha and Dan, who host onboard parties decked out in their best. They tut at Ned's houseboat, unkempt as his goatee. At night they hear yo-ho-hos upon dead man's chest. The organic ice cream guy is Sunday hungover. Last night at the Fleece, Mod Paul Weller was ace. Now nursing his sunburn and headache with choc chip, he hates Sunday crowds who force him to work late. Overhead, air ballooners trail long, stately shadows that creep mouse up houses which climb totter down. Elsewhere, sturdy schoolgirls in love with their ponies trot homewards, cross Clifton's, lush green, Durdham Downs.
Oh, it's a nice little trip around the whole of Bristol. So you covered pretty much everywhere there.
I think I did. Thank you very much.
Do you have any more poetry?
I do, yes.
Okay.
The girl who's going to eat worms. Bite their heads off all the juice up. And it's there, that remembered crunch of wet earth, brimful of dead leaves, long gone snapdragons and wallflowers planted out each late summer by Mum. "You can have Anne round for tea," she says. Mud pies, fingers scoop like an artisan's implement as I push into the soft yield of earth's flesh, wet from rain, and out, holding my trophy aloft. I am Magua, plucking the heart from the chest of a red-breasted British soldier, clod-cupped and claggy. "Go on, eat it," says Anne. A worm pokes its head through, mimicking the dance of a cobra, emerging like a question mark from its snake charmer's basket. "I dare you," says Anne, "go on." Pop, in it goes. Mould smell and grit scrunch as cockles plucked from western mudflats. Now when I walk my dog through Lee Woods, catch a whiff of damp autumn leaves, I want to run, crashing through the undergrowth, whooping and hollering as I jump up and down in puddles.
Clod cupped and claggy, Rosemary Dunn. Thank you very much.
Joined now by Tim Burrows. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Great. And what do you have for us today? Here you have a song.
There's been lots of songs written about hobos and that used to ride the rails and stuff. And Ray Cooder did a whole album of these sort of songs. And this is my take on that sort of song.
Great.
So I hope you like it. I'm an old hobo, I ride the rails under the starry sky. When the whistle blows, I'll climb on board, wave my troubles goodbye. I've ridden from Chicago down to L.A. and out Monterey, from the Rockies to the Appalachians, from the Atlantic to the Pacific Sea. My soul leaves it all behind, save jobs and warm lovers' arms, be free and all alone. I've ridden from Chicago down to L.A., from New York to Monterey, Rockies to the Appalachians, Atlantic to the Pacific Sea. There's something in me that has to move, feel the wind in my hair, feel the rattle of the rails in my bones, rise in a darkened sky. I've lived
there's a hobo riding the rails. Says a hobo, I'll die. They bury me close to the rail side, so I can hear those trains roll by. I've ridden from Chicago down to LA, from New York to Monterey, from the Rockies to the Appalachians, from the Atlantic to the Pacific Sea.
Thanks, Tim. I hear you have a gig up and coming.
Yes, I'm playing tomorrow, that's Monday, at Mr. Wolf's. I'm first act on, so that'll be home about 8:30, so that'll be good. And I'll have my keyboard player, Chris, along.
Great. Get yourself down there.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to introduce the What's On Guide. Jeff Sparks is not in, but he sent his script, and we have a representative on the behalf of Jeff Sparks called Addy, who will now read the What's On Guide for this week.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 30th of March, Skarker Face will be performing at the Continental in South Mellow Lane, Preston. Tickets are £5 in advance and £6 on the door, and the doors open at 8 p.m. Also on 30th of March, Blackfire will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Stackridge. This group formed in 1969 in the Bristol Bath area, and through various splits and reforms have to date released 10 studio albums, 1 live album and 6 official compilations. This is from the album A Victory for Common Sense, which was released in 2009 and is the track titled Old Country.
Me and the miss home and away, paid off the mortgage, kids gone astray. Live like a gypsy, off like a shot. It's the life, or maybe not. Dreamt of the semi-extension and all. Like to return, cause I'm feeling the call. Maybe that is how it all to go. Back to the old country. Silver's in town tonight. Waltzing Matilda, God save the Queen. Flip-flops or mufflers stuck in between. Maybe that is how it ought to go. Back to the old country. The rain, the chips, the wind, the stolen cars. Pasty faced and skins and life on. Sun could be retired or just on the run. Pina colada, girl on my knee. I'd give it all for a cup of tea. Ducking and diving under the sea. Ride on a camel to drink of a lee. I'm not sure that that's the life for me. Back to the old. Back to the old country.
That was Stackridge with Old Country from the album A Factory for Common Sense, which was released in 2009. For information, you can check out www.stackridge.net. Into Saturday, 31st March, the San Uses will be performing at the Fiddlers in Wilway Street, Bristol. Tickets are £7 in advance and £9 on the door, and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 1st April, local journalist and researcher UG Brown will be presenting a talk on Bristol's myths and urban legends at Arras Vale Cemetery in Bristol. Tickets are £7 each or £5 for concessions, and the talk begins at 3 p.m. That is all for me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Addy, thank you very much.
That's all from Dialect this week. Studio guests were David Worthington, manager of John Wesley's Chapel and the New Rooms in Bristol. It's open from Monday to Saturday, 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. Coffee, cakes and tea on the Saturday mornings. So, sounds very exciting.
Radio features were by Anthea Page and Tony Goldsing. Malcolm Grieve read another chapter from Lady Hester Stanhope's very hopeful book, Journey, about her travels in the Middle East. It's got a good ending. Poems were by Rosewood Dunn, and we also had some poetry and music courtesy of Tim Burrows. The presenters were myself, John Peters Coleman.
And myself, Michaela Dennis. Goodbye until next week. The engineer was Michael Noyce and the producer was Anthea Page.